Thank you so much, President Riccobono. We will certainly talk about tomorrow, but to get to tomorrow, we have to talk about a little bit of it about yesteryear and what has where we have come and how we have gotten here. And we're celebrating the 30th anniversary of the Americans with Disabilities Act. On July 26th, 1990, President George H.W. Bush signed the ADA into law. And many of us were trying to predict at that time what it would mean for us as a blind community, what it would mean for the National Federation of the Blind, how we could use it, what did we have to worry about. And that's a little bit what we're going to talk about, but we will also address the future, because even though we have made great strides over these many years, and an example of the great strides we have made show up in Laurel Wolk and knocking down barriers so that she could climb those steps to very, very high places. And I've got to say, Laura, I look forward someday, I'll be an old lawyer probably by then, suppose I already am an old lawyer, but anyway, someday I look forward to arguing a case in front of you. So anyway, let me briefly introduce this august panel that we've assembled this evening. And I realize that we are the last thing between you and your virtual happy hour, so please hang in with us, all right? We have on this panel Dr. Mark Maurer, who is, of course, our immediate past president of the Federation, and he is now the director of our legal programs, and he really truly played just an imperative role in developing our legal policy. We have Dan Goldstein, who's now a retired attorney, but founded the firm of Brown, Goldstein, and Levy, and really helped us to craft our legal policy in the early years of the Americans with Disabilities Act. We have Eve Hill, who is now a partner at Brown, Goldstein, and Levy. We, of course, worked with her when she was at the United States Department of Justice as a deputy assistant Deputy Assistant Attorney General in the area of civil rights, and specifically had charge over the disability rights section of DOJ. And our last panelist is Tim Elder, who is the principal owner, manager, founder of TRE Legal in California. He's second vice president of the National Association of Blind Lawyers, and he, of course, is the president of the National Federation of the Blind of California. He is the youngest member on this panel, the least experienced lawyer on this panel, but even in his few short years in the legal profession, he has already had a tremendous impact on shaping our policy, on shaping the legal landscape. So we have just truly an amazing panel here this evening. So I want to spend just 1 second on the origins of the ADA. Because at an anniversary like this, all of these people get up, congressmen and women and professors and lawyers, and they say, you know, I was the founder of the ABA. I was one of the founders of the ADA, and I did work that caused it to come into being. But I would submit to you, ladies and gentlemen, our founder, Dr. Jacobus Ten Broeck, really truly was one of the authentic founders of what became the Americans with Disabilities Act. Why do I say that? It's because Dr. Ten Broeck boldly, bravely declared that the blind had a right to live in the world, and that right had to be secured by law. And he is the one who initiated the laws that we called later on white cane laws. He is the one who in 1964, when the Civil Rights Act was being debated before Congress, said that disability should also be a protected status under law. No one else was saying that then, or at least very few people. And it is his work, his legal thinking, that really allowed us to develop all of the disability rights laws that came after. So we have a great deal of debt that we have to still pay to Dr. Ten Broeck and his amazing work. So Dr. Maurer, I want to first turn to you and ask you to tell us, when the ADA was first being developed, what did the Federation think of it?
So, Scott.
Yes, sir.
I have a response to this question, but I want to say about the Americans with Disabilities Act that it is an important law. It is not the most important thing, however. The law is important only to the extent that people think it's important. There are a number of them that nobody much cares about. And so the question about the Americans with Disabilities Act is partly that it's there and partly that people think it's important. And in order to make it important, the people who interact with things like law and the life that we live that is affected by law have to think it's important, and they have to behave as if it's important. And so you take today's presidential report. That shows that we think this is important, and we're causing other people to come to have the same opinion. And so the most important thing is not the law itself, but how we behave with respect to it. When we thought about the Americans with Disabilities Act in the beginning, we thought you could interpret it two ways. You could say that because you have a disability, you have certain things to which you are entitled. And if you say that those things are the right to equal access to information and so forth, then the law is well understood and may be interpreted to give us opportunities that we didn't have. If you say that because I've got a disability, you must employ me, then that is a problem. We have to do our part to demonstrate our capacity. And we were worried that all the talk about the rights of people with disabilities would mean in the beginning that people thought, just because I've got a disability and just because we now have this law, I have a right to certain property interests that I didn't before. What we wanted was equality of opportunity, not equality of result. If you earned the result, then we thought it was worthwhile. As I said to Dan Goldstein decades ago, close to 30 years now, I said, unless we can show that the disabled have economic benefit in the society in which we live, it doesn't matter how many laws we pass. If we pass a law that says we have equality and we can't compete, then we don't deserve it and the law won't work. We have to demonstrate the economic benefit that we have at the same time. So we wanted equality of opportunity with all of that, which is implied by the thought, which is an enormous amount. We did not want to say that with this law, we have a right to demand that some of what you have, either you government or you employer or you whatever, have got to give it to me. We wanted the opportunity to earn our way, and we were worried that the law might be interpreted improperly.
And I would say that certainly that was a valid concern at the time. It probably is still a valid concern, but it's been interesting. The ADA over the years has been interpreted so narrowly that it has not given us the benefit, I think, that we thought maybe it would. Dan Goldstein, what would you say to this question? How did the NFB start developing a policy or a practice of taking advantage of the ADA? How did we use it as a tool?
Well, that really started about 9 years after the passage of the ADA. For many years, we were reactive in the sense that somebody would come with a problem and Dr. Maurer would decide this was a problem that should be handled with a legal action. And so we did that. And then in late 1999, Dr. Maurer pointed out the tremendous consequences that were flowing from the digital world taking over. And they were negative consequences, and they were gratuitous consequences. They were barriers that did not need to be there when, in fact, in the absence of barriers, there would be an equality that hadn't been there before. And he set forth as the task getting developers to think about the word us as including the blind when they develop technology. And we then, some of it was reactive, but very often it wasn't. ATMs were a terribly important convenience. So we went after the accessibility of ATMs. Sometimes it was slightly reactive. There was a fellow who wasn't an NFB member who took over, sued Maryland over inaccessible voting machines. And the judge did not have confidence in him and asked us to step in. And we did. And it began a long series of very important voting cases. And of course, the first of these that we did was against AOL. So the strategy evolved as we learned. One of the things we learned very early on is there are giant holes in the ADA. We can't go after inaccessible technology directly in most cases using the ADA. So we had to pressure the customers of those technologies by suing them instead.
So I think from my perspective, these cases really started to help define what purposes we had for our legal program and how we started to make decisions about the cases we would take and those we wouldn't. Dr. Maurer, would you like to comment a little bit about how we developed the purposes of our legal program?
Well, the idea was to see that we could get accommodations that were going to help people get employment. You've got this great big piece of employment law in the Americans with Disabilities Act, and yet the unemployment rate is enormous. And the opportunities that the Americans with Disabilities Act might give to employment should be huge. And there was a lot of study about it in the 1990s, and people said that this was going to cost the United States enormous amounts of money, and yet the unemployment rate remained the same. And those of us who got involved in litigation with respect to employment found that most of the time we lost. And we lost because people said it was just not practical to have people with disabilities be employed. There's a 1999 Supreme Court case which causes my blood to stir still, even though it's 21 years old, in which Chief Justice Rehnquist made the statement that it would be rational and therefore constitutional for a state with scarce resources, and what state doesn't have scarce resources, to say that they weren't going to employ people with disabilities because they should reserve the resources that were not too abundant. And by saying this, you get the idea that it's more expensive to have the disabled around as a matter of law, and that the disabled aren't as productive as those who don't have disabilities as a matter of law. And I read this case and I say, how does the justice know? Is it in the record? Can you demonstrate it? Is this a piece? Anyway, you can see why it stirs me still. And yet, not all of the cases have been that way. And so we looked at what was out there, we looked at the possibilities, and we thought, do we think this one has a better than even chance of success? And especially people like to sue the government, and I know this. The government doesn't mind, or at least it doesn't seem to. There are lots of lawyers that are employed by the government. They've got huge legal offices and they've got almost an inexhaustible budget. And yet, if you sue the Internal Revenue Service, you've got sympathy on your side instantly, even though it's the government, and the government has many, many advantages. Still, the public is with you, and even the judges seem to take a kind of an interest in it. Consequently, we looked at the cases and we tried to figure out which ones we thought we could win and which ones we could use to advance the opportunities. I asked Dan Goldstein one time, you've got this employment piece in the Americans with Disabilities Act. Why does it not let us sue people who are paying subminimum wages? And after a while, I came back and he said, well, there's this exception. And I thought, you've got a whole piece of legislation which says that there ought to be equality of opportunity, and yet the subminimum wage statute remains on the books. So you can't attack it directly. You have to attack it indirectly. Well, we did a lot of indirect attack and expanded our reach each time we did and tried to get somebody to pay attention. So far, we haven't frightened anybody to death, or at least not so that I can tell. We did get a magnificent settlement in the Target case, and that changed the technology world. It couldn't have been done, I think, without the AOL case, but the Target case helped to get on the map the idea that access to this internet, which was becoming the entire world, had to be considered a possibility. We still have a long way to go, but we made a long stride that day.
So let me now bring Eve Hill into this. Eve, you've come into our legal program a little bit later, and certainly one of the struggles that we have had over the years is getting the courts to accept the idea that the internet really is something that is covered by the ADA. But there's still this tension between whether or not an entity's goods and services are connected with a physical place or whether or not it's just purely virtual. Some courts say that if it's purely virtual, we have no right of access to it. Where do you think we are and where do we need to go?
Well, in the technology space, there is this hang up, which is honestly a tricky argument made up by defense lawyers, unfortunately bought by courts, that place of public accommodation means physical place. So they've been making that argument all over the place. The good news is nobody's actually bought that argument yet in a web case. So people keep thinking, oh, there's a split in the circuits. But as we all pointed out, In the Domino's Pizza case, there's no split in the circuits right now. The Ninth Circuit has said you have to have a physical place. Other circuits have indicated you don't have to have a physical space, but never in a website case. So I'm thinking we're still going to do okay in this eventually. But I think because the internet really didn't take off until just about the time that the ADA was passed, they didn't think about these emerging technologies in the way they probably would now. So what we say in the case of a building is, if you build a new building, got to be accessible. And there's liability, at least in some circuits, for the architect and the designer and the builder if they don't make it accessible. So there's an argument to be made, I know because I've made it, that websites and other technologies that were built since the ADA should be built accessibly from the beginning, and that we should stop putting them in the area of effective communication and treat them as something that's new, and there should be no excuse for building something new inaccessibly. So we'll see if that plays out. But right now, because the Justice Department, I know I'm so ashamed, has not undertaken its regulatory responsibilities, that's not there. I think this great thing about the ADA, the 30th anniversary, is we're starting to get, I hope, I may just be really optimistic today, a little bit over the hangover of the charity model of disability. So the ADA rejected that. No, it took no pity all the way. We can do everything we can do. And all the assumptions that say we can't are out of here. You look at us, you disfigure it if we have a disability, if we're qualified, and then you give us the accommodations to do our job. And then courts for 10 years said, no, you're not disabled enough. We don't feel bad for you, so you don't have a disability. So you're not disabled enough, so you're not covered. Oh, you're disabled enough to deserve charity, so you can't do the job. There was no winning at all. The good thing is now I'm starting to encounter judges who go, yeah, people with disabilities can do whatever. And that's this definition of disability as meaning you can't work isn't the case. So at least some of the assumptions that underlay the law that allows people to be kept in subminimum wage sheltered work are crumbling. And I think that gives us a lot of hope.
Well, Eva, I hope you're right. But I can also imagine situations where we think we have secured a victory, but maybe we haven't. And so, Tim, I'm going to bring you into this now. And this is going back to the employment context. You know, you were involved with the Rhea Zuden case where we won a jury trial, but did we win?
We did in some respects. And first, let me say, the team and the legal work that we do as a federation to advance the ADA over the last 30 years, this is the best. Like, this is the best work out there in disability rights, access to digital technology. Our team and the legal work that we're doing, we are leading this on a global scale. And so it's been an absolute privilege to be a part of it. I choose this career and I've chosen to do this work because it is amazing and it makes an impact. There's a lot of other things that we might be doing as attorneys, but this work really is meaningful. And I've seen the difference that it's made from Target.com and some of our other victories. Rhea Zuden, the battle continues on for Yasmin, but it is a victory and to some extent. And I think we also need to really be looking at the future and what technology means in the employment space. We cannot deal with this reactive approach any longer. We really need to be thinking about how do we go upstream, right? The technology is being developed through the stream of commerce. A developer is building one piece, it's combining it with another developer, they're combining it into a platform, they're selling it to someone else, and then they're selling it to the employer at the end of the stream. If accessibility has to be dealt with at the end of the stream, we're never gonna win this war. We have to figure out ways to take the law that we have and strategize and reach further up that stream, impose liability, make those developers at the top of the chain understand that they have some responsibility, they have liability. And as Dr. Maurer said, they have to think that this is important. And for our employment work, I see that as really the future of where we're going to need to go. Artificial intelligence, what does that mean? I'm excited to work on some of these emerging issues. We've got a lot of questions, but I'm excited to see what the next generation is going to do. You know, Kaylee, when you're an amazing disability rights lawyer, working with Dr. Bennett on how to make sure AI doesn't discriminate against blind applicants, I'm excited to see what you're going to come up with over these next 30 years.
But I wonder, Tim, well, on that point, you know, are we going to be able to get there through litigation and through the existing law, or are we going to have to change the law?
I think we have to do things differently than we have done. And that's always been true. And we've always adapted and moved forward. I mean, I think this convention is a great example of how we as a community are very innovative and we're very creative and we've got a huge talent pool to use. And so we can't just look at the law either. It's not just litigation anymore. It's litigation plus. The work we do is amazing, but frankly, it's a drop in the bucket compared to the level of compliance that is actually happening out there in the real technology world. we need to figure out ways to harness other forms of technology, to make the technology work for us, to use litigation combined with other strategies. For example, what are we doing to crowdsource self-advocacy? We need to be doing big landmark cases at the very top and at the Supreme Court and things that trickle down, but we need to empower more people to self-advocate in small claims court, in administrative proceedings, to have more toolkits that use automation and efficiency to bring more attention to digital accessibility and legal compliance. We can't just look at it as the court is our forum of enforcement any longer. We do have to think really strategically about how we use our litigation in connection and integration with many other strategies, media, perception, automation, efficiency. There's a lot of exciting stuff coming out with artificial intelligence. I think in some cases we're going to be using artificial intelligence to generate advocacy for individuals even. So I'm excited for these next 30 years.
Yes, Dr. Mallory.
You got to be careful what you wish for here. If you look at what Tim has said in one way, what he indicates is that we need lots more lawyers doing lots more cases.
No.
And if you really come to that, what you want is lots more bright lawyers doing the proper cases in the proper way. We got a bunch of lawyers out there who are doing the ADA and the disabled no good at all by bringing cases that are eminently likely to lose.
Mm-hmm.
Well, and that's true. And I was just going to transition to the sort of the final point here. And that is, you know, we have, at first I would say we were reluctant about the ADA, but then we realized in some ways we had to shape its effects and how it impacted people and shape how the law would be crafted in this area. And one of the things we did, and Dan Goldstein here was a great proponent of this, is establish the Jacobus Tenbroek Disability Law Symposium in 2007. And we also were the leading entity in forming the Disability Rights Bar Association, where we are trying to steer lawyers who practice in the disability rights arena in the right direction. And I think, you know, that's not exactly as a result of the ADA, but it is as a result of us trying to shape the way the ADA is used as a tool. And Dan, I think I heard you wanted to get in on this, and then we're going to have to wrap up in just a minute. But Dan, why don't you give us your thoughts?
Well, I was just going to say that there's clear that we need more legislation because the ADA does not cover the waterfront. It doesn't require in the employment area, although there's language about methods of administration that discriminate. Most judges only understand that there's something about reasonable accommodation in Title I, and that makes it very hard to attack. But we need non-litigation methods as well. Tim is absolutely right, because most judges now force you to settle. So there are no target cases in the sense of opinions that we can point to, except when we litigate against states. Everybody else ends up settling things. And, you know, there are too many websites to be able to litigate them one website at a time. So we're going to have to be creative about new and different ways. What I think we can lay credit to up to this point is that we have increased awareness of accessibility and a clearer understanding of disability than existed when we got started. But I don't think by any other measure we can claim what we've done has been a success.
Well, I think you're right, Dan. And I think there's another aspect of this, and I think this is where we can end, but we still have to do a lot of work in this community to make this legal community and the pursuit of disability rights look like the rest of our society. We've realized in the last couple of years that when you look at lawyers who practice disability rights law, and you look at the people who have been bringing the cases, in the Disability Rights Bar Association, for example, 86% of the attorneys involved are white. And there's a real dearth of lawyers of diverse background in this area. And quite frankly, there's a great dearth of lawyers with disabilities from diverse backgrounds. And quickly, panel, what do we need to do to change that?
One of the things I want to say is that I'm proud of your work with the American Bar Association, because part of what we have to do is get the bar itself to know that disability rights is a part of the law and a part of the respected element of practice of the law, and ought to be an element of the Bar Association that gets the respect it deserves. You have brought that into being, and I admire you for doing it. But there has to be program on the main part of the Bar Association agenda, as there does with state bar associations. We have to get the lawyers to know that disability law is still there, and lots of them have never heard of it.
And I think also part of the problem is a pipeline issue. There just have not been a lot of diverse backgrounds involved in this area, and certainly among lawyers with disabilities. But I have hope. And the reason I have hope is, take a look at our scholarship class this year. We have, I don't know, five or six people interested in either in going to law school or who are in law school. And that class is incredibly diverse. And so I have hope for the future. I think we have made some important strides. We've had great victories, but we have just scratched the surface. And I know that because of the team that we've assembled here, because of the lawyers that we will get involved in this area, and because of our members, we will secure our right to live in the world. And I think, Mr. President, even though this could probably go on all evening and deserves more attention, I think we'll turn it back over to you at this point.